an informational meeting, and I'm asking the Parks and Recreation Department to come forward first and do an overview. Mike, glad you're here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I understand that you, as much as you are interested in an overview, you really want a heads up on issues that may be coming to your attention this session, so I'll do just a very quick overview. And I've distributed some handouts that I'll refer to as I go through this. For the record, my name is Michael Carrier, Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is led by a 7-member commission who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And there is one member representing each congressional district of Oregon and 2 members who serve at large, one representing the area east of the Cascades and one representing the area west of the Coast Range. The mission of the department is to provide outstanding natural, scenic, cultural, historic, and recreational sites for the enjoyment and education of present and future generations. Our responsibilities include the development and management of 230 state parks and recreation areas encompassing 95,000 acres. We're also responsible for stewardship of the ocean shores, 14 state scenic waterways, the Willamette Greenway, and several heritage conservation programs, which include the State Historic Preservation Office, the Oregon Heritage Commission, and the Pioneer Cemetery Commission. We operate on a budget for the current biennium in which we expect $135 million in revenues and $130 million in expenditures. Our sources of revenue include lottery, which is dedicated through ballot measure 66, adopted in 1998, through park user fees, which constitute about 36% of our budget, and recreational vehicle registration fees. We also receive some federal funds and other dedicated funds, such as the all-terrain vehicle permit fee that we sell. We have a full-time equivalent workforce of 501, which constitutes 740 positions. As you can imagine, the seasonal nature of our work requires that we employ a number of seasonal employees. We host, in this past year, we had a record year in outdoor recreation in Oregon, at least in our state park system. We hosted over 2 million overnight guests in our state parks and 38 million day visitors. We're close to the top in, across the country in terms of visitation and park use. I've provided for you a copy of our 2001-2003 biennial report. I sent this to you previously with a cover letter. We're required to produce this as one of the conditions of ballot measure 66. And I've also provided for you a small document which really represents the strategic vision of the State Parks and Recreation Commission. We are a commission-led agency, and it's called Target 2014, and it establishes 8 broad goals that the commission adopted after the adoption of Measure 66 to ensure that we had a clear vision for what we were going to accomplish with that money over the next 15 years and that we could identify the performance criteria that we intend to meet. I'll just give you a quick overview. The other handout I've provided is a summary of our legislative concepts. We have 6 concepts that we've presented, and I'm pleased to say that all have been slated for hearing now. And 2 deal with fee waivers in our department. One is we're seeking the authority to waive permit application fees to local and tribal government, and I believe we've included federal government in the concept, when they're applying for an ocean shores permit in which the work would result in some benefit to the public, similar to the kind of project that we would undertake. We've been actually waiving those fees for a number of years, and it was noted by legislative counsel a couple of years ago that we actually didn't have statutory authority to do that. We want to continue offering those waivers, and in fact we got clear direction during our Ways and Means hearing 2 years ago that we ought to be waiving those kinds of permit application fees. The other fee waiver authority is related to other park fees, and we have been waiving those for a number of reasons at different times over the past several years, and we want to ensure that in statute we've got clear authority to do that. So that's one that I hope will come before you after it passes through the House. And then we have 3 concepts regarding to the Pioneer Cemetery Program. 1, to change the name of the body to the Commission on Historic Cemeteries to recognize the fact that we are trying to identify and protect tribal cemeteries as well as pioneer cemeteries. We're seeking to increase the penalties for destruction or other acts, illegal acts in those cemeteries. And We're seeking to have the Pioneer Cemetery Commission have some level of review before such cemeteries are abandoned or memorials removed or remains disinterred. And finally, we're seeking authority, as a number of agencies are these days, to conduct criminal background checks on employees and volunteers. Oregon State Parks is unique in that it enlists the services of over 4,000 citizen volunteers in our parks, doing every imaginable job, supplanting the need for about 270 full-time employees. We receive about 400,000 hours annually of volunteer effort from these folks, and it's a tremendous asset. But because they work in the presence of park visitors and include families and children and other vulnerable populations, we want to ensure that, and because many of them are from out of state, we want to ensure that we have the opportunity to fully check out their background when they're applying for sensitive volunteer or work employment duties. Those are our legislative concepts. If I may, I'll just identify three issues that I think may come to your attention. However, only one of them I would expect to come before you as either a report from the department or as some necessary legislative action. The first issue that I wanted to give you a heads up on regards the Lower Deschutes River Management Plan. The Lower Deschutes River is designated as a state scenic waterway. It is also designated as a federal wild and scenic stream and also designated as a tribal wild and scenic stream. And there is an interagency agreement between the BLM, the Warm Springs Tribe, and our department to jointly manage that river. And there was a 1993 environmental impact statement prepared by BLM, which has taken the lead in doing the management plan under NEPA. And then a 97 supplement to that impact statement that actually laid the foundation for how that river would be managed. The concern dates back to the early 80s when the use of that river by rafters and others was so heavy that the social and environmental conditions were degrading to the point where the recreation experience was negative rather than positive, and folks were concerned about degradation of the resource. The 97 supplement provides for a number of measures to be undertaken by the three agencies, or the tribes and the two agencies, to improve the social and environmental conditions and to monitor the use of the river with the goal of trying to get used to be reduced to a level where the conditions improve. The plan also provides that if a certain levels of use are hit, that a limited entry system would be triggered on that river at some time, in which voters would not be allowed on without a permit, and numbers would be prescribed beyond which the daily use would not be permitted. And that's been a point of controversy because the methodology for counting users on the river has been called to question, and we've enlisted the assistance of Oregon State University to improve that methodology, and they've been very successful in helping us with that. But there's also a lot of concern because the social and environmental conditions on the Lower Deschutes have in fact improved and the use has in fact declined. However, it appears that trigger prescribed in the 97 supplement has been hit. So there are some that are clamoring for us to implement limited entry, and there are some who are saying, look, we're on a trend of improved in conditions. Let's keep working on that and use non-permit measures to avoid a limited entry system. And therein stands the conundrum or a problem that we're faced with today, is whether to go forward with a limited entry or to continue working on non-permit measures. We continue to work on that with the BLM and with the Warm Springs Tribe. We don't all agree. We're slated to have an executive committee meeting of myself and the tribal chair, the head of BLM, and the head of BIA to try and work this out. And at this point, I'm uncertain as to what we'll arrive at. But it has been the position of our department that the plan clearly says we'll do everything we can to avoid triggering limited entry, and we think that we ought to continue in that vein.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So where are the tribes?
The tribes feel very strongly that the limited entry system ought to be implemented.
Don't provoke a lawsuit, please. Do what the tribes want.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I'm very sensitive to the government-to-government relationship and especially sensitive to what the tribes have experienced on the Lower Deschutes. In November, after an impasse was reached among the managers from the respective entities, I went out and met with the tribal chair to see if we could work together to come up with a solution to this before we go to the executive committee meeting, because the last thing I would like to do is go in there without some idea that we're going to reach an agreement that's acceptable both to the tribes and the other parties.
Mr. Chair, I've rafted on that river since the late 70s, and I would respect the tribe there very deeply, even if they limited my access to that river. I feel the same way about the Rogue. You know, I mean, it's not a tribal issue down there, but I think the Warm Springs have done a very good job of managing that, and I think we ought to be very respectful of that.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Shields, Senator Clinton, just one follow-up response to that. The tribe I put on the table, I thought, a very reasonable compromise proposal in October, which was to trigger the limit entry, but only on segment one. There are four segments that are managed on the river, and segment one is that segment that traverses along the tribal lands. And I think that everyone could accept that as a pilot, and it's a reasonable proposal. The only issue of difference here regards another provision of the plan, which calls for all permits to be issued in a common pool, which gives the outfitters and guides who serve that river and the non-raft owning public a lot of heartburn, because it's the only river in the nation that would be managed in that way. All the others have a split allocation where a certain number of permits are reserved for guides and outfitters to assure that they have access. And that's really the one issue that we need to resolve with the three parties. I'd like to move on to the other issue, and that's Senate Bill 606 in 2001 extended a sunset on recreational placer mining in scenic waterways. When the scenic waterways were adopted, there was a clear intent that placer mining, at least industrial placer mining, would cease in those rivers. And there was an Attorney General's opinion that said that recreational placer mining, which is mining with a motor of less than 10 horse and a section of less than, I don't remember the exact diameter, but a smaller hose, did constitute placer mining and should not be allowed. And then there was a conflicting opinion later that said that it, in fact, was a recreational activity and did not fall within the definition of placer mining. So the Division of State Lands has been issuing permits for placer mining on the Rogue for a number of years, and for about the last three sessions there has been a sunset that just keeps getting extended out that would end the issuance of those permits. Each time that sunset was extended, our department was asked to prepare an analysis of the effects of recreational placer mining on the river. We've completed that with help from the Natural Resource Institute at Oregon State University. We've conducted not only a review of placer mining, but a review of the entire scenic waterway program. And we're required to report back to the legislature this session on the results of those two studies, and I suspect I'll be bringing that to your committee later this session. We just received the reports. We're going to be working with the other state agencies, with the recreational placer miners, and other interested parties to ensure that there's no dispute about the findings in the reports, and then we'll work with the state agencies to come up with a common position and recommendation regarding whether that sunset should be extended indefinitely or whether it should be allowed to go into effect, which in that sunset would occur at the end of 2003 if it does go into effect. So that's an issue I'll be back to report on you in more detail. Finally, I wanted to just brief you quickly on a project that our department undertook beginning 2 years ago, and it will probably take a couple more years, and that's a comprehensive management plan for the Oregon ocean shores. We found that for the last 30-some years, we've been managing resource management and recreation issues on the ocean shores on a case-by-case basis, and we were long overdue for a comprehensive inventory of what the natural resources and recreation demand and uses and patterns and future expectations are for the ocean beaches, and to come up with a common vision for how we will manage and accommodate those uses. This is especially critical now because we have one federally and state listed threatened species, the western snowy plover, which nests on the Oregon coast and for which the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been requesting annually for the last 7 years that we restrict use on segments of Oregon's beaches during the nesting season, and for which the service is preparing a recovery plan which could affect even larger portions of the Oregon coast. So along with the Ocean Shores Management Plan, we're doing a habitat conservation plan for western snowy plover for the purpose of receiving an incidental take permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so we can assure that major stretches of the ocean beaches are kept open for public recreation and that habitat recovery and plover recovery efforts are conducted where it is truly viable and where the public understands and accepts it. So those are the three issues I wanted to brief you on. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, thank you. I had just one quick question, and then we'll go to Senator Fisher. And that is, I've read a couple of those biennial reports that have been made on the recreational placer mining. Will this have anything truly new in it?
Mr. Chair, yes, it will. The past reports that our department submitted, I will confess, I feel were very cursory reviews and very inadequate, and that's why this time we went outside and got expertise from Oregon State University, and the report is thoroughly annotated. They did a very thorough literature review of all the latest research on the effects of placer mining and how those could be mitigated. And I think this report will be much more thorough than what you've seen in the past.
I want to thank you in advance for that, because having looked at a couple of them, it looked like one was almost a template from which the next one was made, you know. And there's a lot of things you can do with computers, and one is not really do the research, you know. And so I appreciate what you've said.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and that is exactly the reason the inadequacy of those reports is exactly the reason the legislature chose to simply extend that sunset date each time this issue came up.
Right. Thank you. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, Mike, I just wanted to go back, and you've got a name change here for the Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission. How much is that going to cost?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, we anticipate no cost to change the name. They do not use department letterhead, and they have a very limited budget. In fact, their entire budget is a part-time staff person who is on our staff and only have a very modest amount of literature. We do have a program option package as part of our budget request to set aside a modest amount of money, about $84,500 a biennium, which is modest to us but important to that group, that would allow them to start producing materials, provide signs for these Pioneer Cemetery Commissions, and actually provide some small grants to owners of Pioneer Cemeteries to afford them protection, things like fencing, signage, memorial restoration.
Yeah, the reason I wanted, there's always stationery, there's business cards, there's everybody else that has to run the change through their address system, postage. In the 10 years I've been in the legislature, there's been enough name changes around, I'm sure, to pretty near pull us out of the situation we are right now as far as the finances. And when you start talking about all the name changes in the university system and everything else, it's got to be, it runs into the millions of dollars. And signage at the locations and all this kind of stuff and all for a name change. We've done it to human resources down to human services instead of human resources. All that has to go through all of the things and all of the upheaval that we've had over there with changing it from SDSD to SPUDs and all of this kind of stuff.
Changes in our Senate districts, oh, it's horrible.
Well, it is. And I, for one, could have gotten by without any change in my stationery and my business cards or anything else if it hadn't been for that. Regardless of what you say, it's an expense that the public has to bear that can be buffered. And I just was curious as to whether, you know, we're sitting here and trying to make a name change that in reality means nothing to the service that's being given. To acknowledge something that I'm not saying is wrong, but at the same time, when you're scratching and looking for every single penny you can get to take care of people that have been bartered pretty shamelessly, you know, I'm not sure it makes sense to do a whole lot of name changing and card printing and stuff and that kind of thing.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On the your two LCs or House bills, I guess, dealing with the permit waiver that you don't have statutory authority to do currently, are you still doing that?
We suspended waiving the Ocean Shores permits until we got statutory authority. And again, those are the permits that we would issue to local or tribal or federal government for recreation or public access improvement. With regard to park fees, that hasn't been an issue with legislative council. No one has offered us advice. It has been my personal desire to ensure that it doesn't become a problem in the future, because since the beginning of this park system and since the very first that they've applied park fees, such as camping fees or day use fees, there have been waivers or exemptions granted for things like volunteers, for promotional purposes, for park hosts are given free camping. And I simply want to ensure that it doesn't become an issue in the future. No, we have not changed our rules or our practices that we've been engaged in for nearly 80 years on those.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to compliment you for actually changing your practices to follow the statute once you found out that your Ocean Shore permits. I mean, not that I don't support the waiver, and I support the idea of granting statutory authority, but I appreciate it when you find out that you don't have authority. You quit doing that until you get authority. That's important.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I don't mean to be super critical, because I have appreciated some of the help Park Service has given down in the district with the Garrison Lake problem and things like that, and really feel you're on the right track in a lot of areas there. And so my comment about the money involved is an observation that I made over a period of time here with some others, and recognizing this is a very small situation, and I, as I say, I don't have a problem with them doing something that would increase a thing beyond just the white man's population of the state, so to speak. But I do want to let you know that I do appreciate some of the changes that I've seen in the operation of the Park Department, and certainly the help that we've gotten down there. I don't know if we could get nature to work with us a little bit here the next few years down there. It'd probably be almost a bigger benefit than anything else. But, thank you anyway for your, and your employees down that way have been very good to work with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, thank you for those kind words. Regard to Garrison Lake, as soon as we close on that property with the seller, he needs to find a replacement property as part of the transaction. We're going to be working with the city to come up with a permanent water control structure that will permanently solve that flooding problem for those residents.
Well, thank you very much for your report this morning.
Thank you.
Let's move on to the watershed enhancement overview, and I'm going to ask Jeff Huntington if he'll come up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeff Huntington, the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I have offered committee staff, and I think it's been distributed to the committee, a packet of a variety of things that are associated with our programs that have been produced over time, and I won't push you through all of that paper, but I thought it was it's information that you might be interested in looking at, and I'll try to meet with each of you individually to discuss some of the specifics that you see in there. I will refer to a couple of them in the next 10-15 minutes and talk to you specifically about them. My program is the result of about a 15-year evolution that started in 1987 with the establishment of the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board and the work as a mechanism for supporting locally sponsored voluntary restoration efforts aimed at helping private landowners work on fish habitat, water quality, and watershed enhancement projects. And over the years, as it evolved, using a variety of funding sources at a demonstration level principally, the program grew and became embedded in many communities all over the state. And if there's one core function that OWEB today has as its mission. It's the same as when we started in 1987, and that is providing resources and help and catalyst and nurturing and whatever we can do to spark innovation at a local level that is community-based and that is sponsored by folks that live on in a particular watershed because it's something they believe is the right thing to do, both for their local economy and for their individual operations, but also for the health of their watershed. And every day and every week in my agency, we spend time trying to figure out whether or not the services we're delivering are the type that are needed to help folks grab hold of local priorities, and if we're delivering them in a way that is helping that progress occur in 100 different ways, maybe 1,000 different ways, depending on where you are in the state. And that's really the essence of what OWEB is about, supporting and investing in locally sponsored voluntary watershed restoration projects. As things evolved in the state, in 1997 we had the listings of some salmon stocks under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and in response to that, the legislature and the governor created something that we've all talked about in this building for several years, and you're probably all familiar with, and that's the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And at that time, the programs of the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board began to morph into becoming a real part of natural resource policy for the state of Oregon and implementing the state's natural resource policy, because it was part of a larger shift. And that larger shift that the Oregon Plan put in place was really to integrate these local delivery mechanisms in different watersheds through soil and water conservation districts and watershed councils to help them affect changes in practices and stewardship on private lands, so that we could put that in the context of a larger effort that the entire state was making to respond to these listings under the Federal Endangered Species Act of our salmon and to respond to clean water concerns and addressing issues under the Clean Water Act. In 1998, Ballot Measure 66 was passed, and I'll be happy to talk more about Ballot Measure 66 if you would like, but the essence is that half of the 15% of the lottery is now dedicated to be supporting parks and watershed enhancement and restoration. So 7.5 cents on every dollar is constitutionally dedicated for a particular purpose. And of that 7.5%, about 65%, a little over half, the voters said has to go on the ground and be used for projects just like I've described. The Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board then was created as a cabinet-level state agency in 1999, in part in response to Ballot Measure 66, which said that a single state agency must administer that half of the lottery funds that's dedicated for watershed enhancement. And OWEB, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, was identified as the agency to do that. And so today, our grant program is principally built around administering the lottery funds that are dedicated for that particular purpose of enhancing watersheds, improving fish habitat, improving water quality, and putting the money on the ground through these local groups, the soil and water conservation districts and the watershed councils. And I believe you're going to hear from some of the local groups today that were invited to come. We don't have a staff that implements projects. We act as a foundation, if you will, that we have a competitive grant program. And so we run grant cycles 3 times a year where applications are made for projects that are then put through a technical review process and then funded. We have a couple of other functions that I'll mention in just a minute that relate directly to implementing the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. But the essence of what we do is our grant program. And I want to talk just for a minute about that grant program, both in terms of how we award grants and the fiscal accountability that we have to provide after we award grants, because that is really a key part of what we do. Before I do that, I at least will point out this is a document that's 2 years old. It was after the OWEB board was formed. They spent a fair amount of time working with the constituencies and identifying in an outcome-based process what it is that we will build our programs around, where we will move toward, what are the strategies for doing that. And this document we're not updating this year because it is just as relevant in terms of driving what we do and the decisions we make today as it was two and a half years ago. It's the rudder for us Everything is built around moving us toward three outcomes of accountability, partnering, and enhancing understanding about individual actions impacting watersheds. And we implement strategies to try and advance toward those outcomes as our ultimate goal. Our funding sources, as I mentioned, primarily are ballot measure 66. We also administer a heavy dose of federal funds that comes from Congress that is allocated to the state of Oregon for the purpose of helping do habitat work and other work associated with recovering the list, the salmon that is listed in the Federal Endangered Species Act. Today, our grant program, when we fund something that is on the ground, a project, it's lottery money. If there is a project that comes in the door that needs to help a landowner by providing technical assistance, by doing monitoring to see what the effect of all of our efforts in Oregon are toward recovering salmon, or to collect data for agency work that can be used to help assist in the strategic location of projects, or to do education work with citizens, that is all funded through federal grants that I administer, federal funds that I administer through our grant program. OWEB receives that federal funds and establishes a spending plan, and have worked hard with the Ways and Means Committees to do that so that we have a general umbrella direction that everyone understands is where the targets for those federal grants, and then we try to push that money through our grant program so it's seamless to the grant recipients, so they don't have to struggle with a separate federal grant application or other requirements that come with those federal funds. And so that's one of the things that we try to do as part of our program is to ease out the requirements and the transactions costs, if you will, for individual groups who are trying to obtain money to help their neighbors and the landowners in their watershed, so they don't have to struggle with a lot of the paperwork and the accountability issue that's there when you're dealing with federal money. One document that is in the packet I gave you is a green document. This is a portfolio of projects, and essentially this is our attempt to lay out basin by basin in 15 basins across the state where the projects are that OWEB funded in the last couple of years, and a brief description of three examples of projects in that particular basin. We use this when we're working in Washington, D.C. to help secure the federal funds and with private foundations to provide private money make private money available to landowners to help leverage the state's investments. And I do spend a fair amount of time trying to bring in private funds to help augment the work that the landowners are doing. When OWEB issues a grant, awards a grant, on average, every dollar that is invested of public money by OWEB is matched 2-to-1 by investment of private funds. Either in kind by the landowner or the receiving group, or in cash through other grant sources. That is a huge ratio for us that we work hard to sustain, and we work diligently with both the folks that are receiving the money to always make sure they have a stake in the project financially and personally, and also to bring in other private funders to help augment the state's investment in watershed restoration projects. These profiles in this portfolio, I think one by one, will give you an example of some of the stories behind the dots, essentially. Another document that I have provided to you that I do want to mention briefly is a series of one-pagers. We've broken out so that you can take a look really easily at what we've done in any given county in the state. And these identify what OWEB's investment was in a particular county, what the match funding was that went with it, and also some results of an interesting study that I had done a year and a half ago. I was curious, frankly, about what the economic impact is of having a sustained investment in restoration activities over time in voluntary projects. And I asked the University of Oregon to come in and take a look at our grant files. And some of what I found was surprising to me, but also very relevant to some of the benefits of our program, both to the local folks, but on a statewide basis. The University of Oregon, after looking at our grant files and examining where the money went, talking to our grant recipients, and tracking our expenditures, found that 80% of the grant funds that we spend stay in the county where the grant is issued. So 80 cents on the dollar stays in the local economy in that county, and over 95% stays in the Oregon economy, in the state. They also came back and said that about every dollar that we spend on restoration efforts has a multiplier effect in the local economy of another $1.60 to $2.50 of expenditures that are related to that project but are indirect. And it's the result of the grant recipient hiring a local contractor, going to the local supply store for fencing or whatever the supplies are that are needed for that project. But that, that piece in particular did surprise me. There's a huge economic stimulus that occurs from sustained investments in local community efforts to restore their watersheds. And it's a different perspective than we're used to talking about. It's something that we haven't discussed much, certainly in my program in the last several years, but in the current climate and times we find ourselves in, it's a very fascinating piece of the puzzle of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And frankly, it is on average at least showing demonstrable economic stimulus in local communities that come from the sustained investment. But it's also an underpinning of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, because one of the pieces, at least in my mind, of the Oregon Plan is to provide the state with control over its own destiny and to turn us in a policy sense from having Oregonians fight over the last drop of water or the last fish into constructing a solution-based approach on a local level that both relies on a regulatory baseline that we all know exists but incorporates in the ability of landowners and local communities to find a secure source of money to invest in making improvements that will insulate them over time from federal mandates like the Federal Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act, which really is can't ever be tailored in its implementation to meet the needs of the local communities. So that's kind of a 40,000 foot level of some of what we're involved in. Coming back down to my program specifically, on the back of each of those one pagers is just a printout from a spreadsheet of examples of the project in that community. And you can take a look and real easily, I hope, see some of the types of folks that are receiving grants and the match that they put to it, and just a thumbnail sketch of what they intended to do with the project as part of their application. One of the services we can provide, frankly, to you all is you're sorting through some of the policy issues that involve water quantity, water quality, Senate Bill 1010 agricultural practices, forestry practices, whatever, is if you are seeking information about what's happening with respect to particular types of projects in particular parts of the state, we have a database and we work with all of the agencies so that we can at least provide information on how much work is happening that involves agricultural lands in a particular part of the state, and what kind of work is it, and what's being done for fish passage or fish screening diversions so that fish don't get sucked into irrigation pipes and so on. And that's something that we're happy to try and do. I will mention another document to you in just a minute that's part of our charge legislatively to report on the Oregon Plan. I want to touch briefly that when on our process, when we get an application, the first thing we do is send it out to regional review teams that are technical teams in different parts of the state, a very decentralized process for reviewing the technical merit of applications, and also if, assuming it's a well-designed project with great technical merit, is it proposed to be implemented in a place that will really make a difference? And those are the two key things that the review process looks at that OEB sponsors. I pull in folks from different disciplines, and there's the OEB staff person is the facilitator of those meetings, but is the only person in the room that doesn't have a vote on whether a project should get funded. Frankly, it's the different expertises that we bring in that I have both field knowledge from that part of the state, but also a experience in working in a different part of the resources: agricultural practices, forest practices, hydrology, fish biology, and we try to bring those folks in to do that technical review. We write a summary of their comments and recommendations, and those are all forwarded to my board, and my board meets four times a year, and acts on every application within a budget that I construct based on the funds that come to us from the lottery money and the federal funds. I have a unique board. It's 17 members. 11 of them vote and are, in one way or another, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Six of those come as direct appointments with one tribal representative, and five of them come via their position sitting as the policy on policy oversight boards for the other natural resources commissions, a member of the EQC, a member of the Board of Forestry, a member of the Board of Agriculture, a member of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So those folks comprise the core and have a group of non-voting members that sit on the board as an advisory capacity, or Oregon State University Extension Service, EPA, National Marine Fisheries Service, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, also sit on the board in a non-voting capacity and help review the appropriateness of how we're trying to strategically invest dollars in response to the applications that come in the door. When we administer a grant, we do it on a reimbursement basis. One of the lodestones of our program is that we don't write a check to the grant recipient. We accept receipts in the door as the project is being implemented and review those receipts against a budget page, a budget that is in every grant agreement, the contract signed between the state and the grantee. And I have a small fiscal staff, but a staff that looks at the basis for the reimbursement request for every grant that is administered by OWEB. We do a small advance at the beginning of the grant, or an advance at the beginning of the grant that's sized to help them get the project going and hire the folks that need to be hired. But from then on, it's a reimbursement basis, and the last 10% of every grant is held until the project's completed with a final report submitted and everything tied up in a way that we're comfortable with. We run on about a little over a 5% overhead at OWEB based on the money that we administer, which, frankly, in talking to private foundations, is a pretty astounding overhead rate relative to the private sector that is engaged in a similar activity. One of the things I'll point out to you that I won't spend time, but I wanted to make sure you had, is the audit report. Under Measure 66, the Secretary of State's office is responsible for auditing the use of Measure 66 money, whether it's through the Parks Department or OWEB, every 2 years, and looking at where that money has gone and every agency that's had any of it and how it's been spent. This just came out on the 30th of December, and essentially that audit gives the Measure 66 a clean bill of health for expenditures in the first audit period. There's some comments, and we are working with the auditors about developing a good set of performance measures so we can measure the results that have accrued from the investments over time, but no concerns in terms of the start that has been made by OWEB and the other agencies on those performance measures, and certainly not on the fiscal accountability end. That's the second audit I've had done. This was a large audit on all Measure 66. I also had an individual audit of OWEB's grant files done by the Secretary of State's office when I first arrived, and with similar results. And I'll be happy to talk about that again individually with you all anytime you would like. The last thing I want to touch on is the additional responsibilities that OWEB was given by legislative charge in the 2001 legislative session, and that is some core responsibility for administering and the implementation of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. Essentially, the Oregon Plan to me is it's a four-legged stool. It is a regulatory baseline that is supplemented by voluntary investments and voluntary restoration actions that is supported by a monitoring program that looks at, over the long term, what is happening as a result of all the efforts and how are we doing, and reporting on that. And the fourth leg is a scientific oversight, and that's provided by an independent science panel that you all established in statute in 1999 or 97, I can't remember which, called the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team. And that science team steps back and assesses whether there's good scientific basis for the decisions that are being made and provides a feedback loop so we can make changes as a state in the way we're approaching recovering native salmonids and improving water quality over time. In the last legislative session, OWEB was handed the charge to do a couple of things that are real key to Oregon Plan implementation. And one of them is to produce this report. This is a biennial report that I was under Senate Bill 945 charged with producing for this legislative session that is not about OWEB, but is rather about assessing and reporting on the implementation efforts for the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And this is a document that has got an awful lot of facts and detail in it available for folks that are busy implementing and assessing how implementation's going. I won't push through it except to say that the first half of the report looks at implementation efforts basin by basin in the state. What's being invested? Who's investing it? What is happening with water quality improvement efforts, and what kind of progress is being made where, and what's the basis for the water quality concerns in a particular basin? Where are the listed species? What are the restoration challenges that the agencies and the local folks in that basin are facing? What are some of the problems that are happening with implementing the plan? And we spent a lot of time gathering that information and then wrapping it at the second half of the document and a statewide view of how implementation is going for each of those four legs of the stool that I just mentioned. The end of the document has some recommendations by the OWEB board on how to enhance the effectiveness. We're busy briefing your counterpart in the House Water Committee, on the implementation efforts this week and next, in fact, with all the agencies talking about some of the things that are included in this report and how things are plugged in order to make progress with the charge for the Oregon Plan. But that's one of the roles for OWEB, is just to track that, roll it up, and provide some kind of accounting to you and to the governor on a biennial basis. And lastly, we coordinate the ongoing monitoring effort for the Oregon Plan. We don't implement the data collection and the monitoring that is happening across the state, but it's our responsibility to work with that science team that's overseeing the plan and the different agencies as the facilitator of making sure that we have designed and in place and being implemented over time a vision for how to track the effectiveness of our regulatory programs and our investments in restoration activities, and to do that in a way that there's some accountability so that at the end point we don't look back and say, we spent a lot of money, and what were the results for that money, and what has been the difference for our fish stocks and for water quality? And we have regulatory programs. Are they being targeted in a way that is making the most difference? And that's the essence of what monitoring is about. And any time, if you have an interest, we'd be happy to bring the right folks to the table to discuss what is the monitoring program plan for salmon and watersheds, and how is it being implemented by the different agencies and by some of OWEB's investments. Or we'd be happy to come in with representatives from the science team and talk about their work in implementing the Oregon Plan. It's a cornerstone of the way we're approaching natural resources in the state today, with the responding to these federal mandates, and it is a real effort to collaborate with different entities that are focused on different parts of the resource, and move us out of an era where we have natural resource policy implemented in kind of a silo basis. We do forestry, we do agriculture, and we do water quantity, we do water quality, but we don't have them fully integrated toward the whole picture in a watershed and how they're functioning. And that's the essence of the Oregon Plan, is to try and integrate, pull off that integration, so that we're looking at the landscape and the treatments that need to be made, whether they're voluntary or regulatory, in order to move us towards some identifiable goals. So I probably talked longer than you wanted, but that's the overview of OWEB and how we fit into something much larger than OWEB.
Thank you, Jeff. You've certainly given us a comprehensive report. A couple questions on my mind as I reflect on this. I hear people say from time to time that they don't understand the Oregon Plan, don't know what it is, et cetera, et cetera. Would you suggest to those folks that they read this from cover to cover and begin the debate after they've done some reading and studying?
Chair Shields, I think that first I'd say that's a legitimate comment that people have had the right to make, that they weren't quite sure what the Oregon Plan was and how it fit with what they were interested in. And secondly, I'd say if we've done our job, you should be able to pick this up, and even without reading it cover to cover, if you live in the Umpqua Basin, you should be able to come away from this by reading a two-page spread and have a good sense of how the Oregon Plan fits in your basin. And if you want to know more on how it's being accomplished on a statewide basis, then you bet that the second half of the document that lays it out tries to do that.
Okay. The other question I had was just kind of about money. You were talking about the ratios of money. Can you mention counties and how much? Just give me an example of a county and how much money has gone into a particular effort, and how much private money, or what the multiplier. I mean, you came up with ratios, but do you have any distinct figures? Just to give us a feel for what this might be like. Just pick a couple.
Certainly, I believe that in over half, Chair Shields, I believe that over half of the counties in the 35 counties in the state of Oregon, 36 counties in the state of Oregon, OWEB has invested over $1 million in this biennium in that county in restoration projects through the competitive grant program. And that's one of the purposes of these county sheets is responding to questions that we had from councils on how do we fit within our county government, but also what is it? How do we fit at a larger scale? If we look at Multnomah County, the one pager I have in front of me shows that we put in this biennium from July 1, 2001 through December 31st, 2002, $1.6 million into 13 projects. And that was matched by $2 million of private money for a total investment of $3.6 million. And that was accomplished through work that involved, we've got about five watershed councils in Multnomah County and two soil and water conservation districts were probably the primary delivery mechanisms. Although I can say right now I'm working with a developer in Portland that is doing affordable community housing that approached us and said, you know, we're at the headwaters of Tryon Creek, and we have an opportunity that the creek's been piped where we're about to put this housing unit. We really would like to integrate a restoration project into our housing project. Are you interested? And we, of course, jumped at talking to them about how to do that, and they are going to daylight a stream, do it in a way that it will provide cool water that will feed a fish-bearing tributary in Multnomah County, and also frame a different type of environment for their affordable housing project. And that is not involving a watershed council or soil water conservation district right out of the chute, but it's clearly something that we're really interested in taking on.
Okay. As an example, to develop what you were saying, you mentioned 1.6 match with 2 million. Does that include the value of the volunteer effort, or have you been able to put that into the... I mean, it's very difficult to assess the value of volunteer effort. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But is that $2 million represent that as well, or is it separate? Is that actual cash?
It is not always actual cash. Some of it is in kind. And one of the things we look for, a minimum of 25% cash or in kind for any given grant application is the floor. And the average, as I said, is about 2-1. But the in kind is frequently labor, and we have cost rates that we apply when there's going to be labor putting in fence by the farmer that would like to have the fence come in. In the case of that project application that I'm mentioning to you, I'm expecting to see next week. We have an application deadline on February 1st. They'll put in the cost of the supplies and the contractor time, some of which that contractor may have incurred anyway as part of landscaping, but because they're reconfiguring the way they're doing it, we're willing to accept it as a match.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
We have in-kind fish as well.
Kind fish.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you.
We have some follow-up comments from the Watershed Councils, the Columbia Slough and Rick Rial. Jay Maurer is here and Jackie Hastings. I'm going to ask them both if they'll come up at the same time and just share with us. When we were talking about this, my feeling was that so much of the time we hear from, you know, the state agencies, and I wanted to hear what was happening in a local setting. So it's up to you guys. You flip a coin, do whatever you want.
Jack and I flipped a coin. I'm going to go first there. It's nice to be with you, and thank you for this chance. I'm Jay Maurer. I'm the coordinator for the Columbia Slough Watershed Council. And down in the near packet of stuff, I brought earlier today a packet. I think it looks like this. There's a text thing, and then there's a map underneath it. And The Columbia Slough watershed is probably one of the most unique watersheds in the state. It's located there in Portland and Gresham, and it's got about 32,000 acres, 51 square miles. About 45% of it's residential and 40% industrial, very important industrial area, and then 15% is parks, wildlife, open space. A little bit of agriculture is left. 85% of the land is private and 15% is public. And then just recently we learned our population from the census people. 158,000 people live in the Columbia Slough watershed. And when we divided that by the state population, that was 5%. So we were quite astounded to figure that out. We've got all kinds of features in the watershed that are laid out here. We've got 20 drinking water wells. We've got 8 jurisdictions, 3 freeways, 2 railroads, 3 drainage districts that have levees that protect the watershed from floodwaters. We've got 2 sewage treatment plants. We've got the big airport. We've got Smith and Bybee Lakes, which is the largest protected wetland within an American city, 1,784 acres. 6 golf courses, and the Port of Portland, which has many unusual features about what it does. Fish, we have 25 species, including in the lower slough, juvenile Chinook salmon and steelhead. And we've got lots of birds that live in this habitat, and we have western pond turtles and western painted turtles and beaver and river otter all in this slough watershed. It's pretty amazing. All this is happening all at the same time. Thousands of people, jobs, you know, and lots of wildlife all happening in this watershed. Every watershed and every watershed council is very unique. And so I wanted to sort of help you get a sense of what, you know, a very urbanized watershed council, what we do or what it's like. I would say that one of our biggest things that we do is just raise awareness about watershed consciousness. One of the things we did is we put signs on all the major roads around the watershed. Nice brown signs with a logo that says Columbia Slough Watershed. People are noticing those things. And then wherever any road crosses the actual waterway, we have other signs. We, for 8 years now, have produced an annual canoe event on the slough to encourage people to come down and see it, because in a lot of ways the slough is hidden behind so many businesses. People have said, I know of the slough, but I don't really know where it is. So now, after 8 years, our regatta attracts 350 people and 160 canoes and kayaks. And we have figured out that it's probably the largest single-day, you know, paddling event in the Pacific Northwest. And we also sponsor smaller things, Canoe the Slough. We have little open houses on a wildlife area called the Soup on the Slough. We get people there to get acquainted with the slough. We now have a full-time educator through an OWEB grant with a program we've invented called Slough School. She does environmental ed to 3,000 kids a year in schools throughout the whole watershed, including summertime programs. Through this involvement, let me just say this. The council brings people together. I think before the council, people weren't thinking about the watershed. They were all doing their regulatory things, but they weren't working together. We create the forum. They come together, and all kinds of things have happened because of this. We're now doing an action plan together. So we've got our people together, and we are working a whole big plan out, and it's going to be quite a deal. We've involved people more. We have our grant from OWEB in a two-year grant is $81,000. We get, on the top of that, from local sources, $66,000. So for, you know, the 81 is like a carrot. We go and get the 66, and the in-kind, like you said, Chair Shields, is very hard to measure, but we get a lot of in-kind from all kinds of people, especially agency people and volunteers. As we have gotten together and we see more about the watershed, one of the things we looked at our population, there's a lot of Spanish-speaking people. So we've translated our big recreation brochure into Spanish. We had a festival to kick this off. We got 250 Latino people to our wildlife center and took kids on canoe rides and had a great time. There's a wildlife area that you'll see these days when you drive on I-5 northward. You're just about to cross the Columbia River. There's the Expo Center. At the Expo Center, just south of the Expo Center, you'll see a wetland. It's now full of water. It's called Vanport Wetlands. that would not be there if it weren't for the Watershed Council. Because the council was involved, it was able to suggest that site to the Port of Portland as a mitigation site. It's a very successful site now. Otherwise, it probably would have been developed with either industrial buildings or a jail. Neighbors at the East End have gathered around Fairview Lake and have conducted plantings every year. And so all these things are occurring because of the watershed. So I think that's the main point I wanted to make, is that the council is fostering action on all kinds of levels that wasn't being done before. We work in concert with all kinds of agencies, DEQ, our local SWCD, and Metro and the cities. So it's a very great partnership, and we have a good time, and I think that's the main sense I wanted to leave. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jackie.
My name is Jackie Hastings. I'm coordinator for the Rickrail Watershed Council. My council consists of 17 diverse members, everything from forestry to environmental to citizens to agriculture and to the soil water districts. We have 17 members that operate on consensus, and if I, you know, you can imagine just the five of you trying to agree on something, we have 17 of us that have to agree. It took them 2 years before they legally were formed, because it took them 2 years of learning to trust each other and learning to disagree but agree to move ahead. Our council's big thing that we do, back up first, we work directly with our soil water district. They are a fiscal agent. They've helped us in all sorts of stuff, including when this last round we didn't have full funding. Our district stepped up and said, okay, we're willing to pick you up one day a week, so that they paid for me to do outreach for them one day a week. So we have a real strong relationship with them. One of the things the district wasn't doing as much is doing the outreach. They work directly with landowners and a lot of agriculture. They have five elected officials who have to own property and do it that way. They hadn't touched a lot of the residents in town and those kind of projects. So that's where they turned to the watershed councils. As the watershed councils, having that diverse group of people, we all of a sudden were in all sorts of different activities and different things. One of the things that we did for years, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been trying to get a farmer who has a low water ford that runs right through Rickrail Creek, and it's blocking fish passage. For years, they've been trying to get him to yank it out. It was put in so long ago that it falls under a grandfather clause that it doesn't legally have to be removed. He'd never be able to put it in today, but because of the way it was. So they hadn't had any luck in it, because the farmer needed to access the other side of the creek where his property was. So that was one of the advantages. We were able to come in and say, hey, what if we come up with some funding? Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has this money. What if we can get a grant to do this? And he said, super. I'm not against doing that. I just can't lose my access. So as a result, we started moving all the wheels ahead. I went back to ODF&W and said, great, they're willing to do this. Will you pay to remove it if we can come up with money to put in a new bridge? And they said, sure. So we were about ready to do it. And in the meantime, we had been working with seven OSU students, sampled our creek on nine different spots for 1 year. Once a month they came up and sampled our creek, because we didn't have any real current fish data. One of the things that they found at the end of this was, wow, this fish blockage, which was blocking Chinook from being able to go any further, was also blocking non-native fish. Anything above that spot, there were lots of other fish, but there was no non-native fish above there. So do you yank that out and let those fish come up into our pristine little watershed, or do you leave it there? So now we're into this big debate. You know, we're working with ODF&W. Our council's viewing this. What does the forester say? And it's kind of funny how two people from the same agency will say completely different things. And so it was a great opportunity. We're now working with a new batch of OSU students who are going to study that same spot for the next year. They're going to test temperature. They're going to test how deep was the water. Is there something else that's adding to it other than just the blockage? They're also doing the same kind of survey on Mary's River, which has a similar spot without a blockage. Are the fish going up further? Are they staying there? So that's given us some great opportunities. As a result, you'll see the little fish booklet, the fish of Rickrail Creek. The students got done and did this great document for us. And from the document, I went in and borrowed their information and created this brochure, What Fish Are in Rickrail Creek. This has been a great tool for us to give out to the landowners, to residents, to everyone. I think that's one of the big things that watershed councils do that are different than other agencies, is we involve everyone. We're a local entity that utilizes local knowledge. Volunteers, we have major volunteers. We received a grant this last round for the Delbert Hunter Arboretum Habitat Restoration Project. As you know, a creek is supposed to move, and it's supposed to make S's and go back and forth. Well, one of the biggest problems that they have is in cities, you can't move. Back in the days when we built our houses right on the edge of the creek, that was cool. So the creek has come through, and it can't move, and they've put riprap in there, and they've done cement, and they've done all these things to try and keep the creek from moving out and taking their property. So instead, the creek's gone straight down. So the Delbert Hunter Arboretum is a group of volunteer senior citizens. All of them are retired, so most of them are, some of the Delbert Hunter himself happens to be 98 years old, and he still comes out and operates on it. They came to the council and said, we have this bank problem, it's eroding in, this land was donated to us, we're going to add on to our arboretum, and what can we do? So we started as this little thing about sloping the bank back and giving the creek a place actually to when the high flows come so that the water could go out into there instead of this channel that it's in right now that shoots straight down the creek into the next people's house. And from that, different agencies got involved, NIMS got involved, ODF&W, and now it's turned into a test pilot for the state of Oregon. And what we're going to do is put in engineered log jams, and what they're trying to do is to actually build the creek back up. Because right now, if you're a fish, you wouldn't want to be in that part because it's just straight and it shoots and there's no gravel, there's nothing. So by putting in these engineered log jams, which I hate that word because it makes me think of the old days when you didn't want logs to hit your bridges. These are actually put into the ground, and they only stick above the ground about this much. And we went out in nature and found some natural places where nature does it, and that's what they're modeling after. So it'll actually put these logs in. It'll start trapping the gravel that's coming down, and it'll start to build the creek back up. Then by taking this area where we slope the bank, we're going to slope it in a different shape and give the water a place to disperse. And so we're hoping this will be successful. We're using this as a test pilot of what can be done for other cities. It's a solution for an urban problem. We were awarded $142,000 to do this project with volunteer time, in-kind match. Weyerhaeuser has donated all the logs. Dalton Rock has donated rocks. The whole project's going to cost around $196,000. So we have almost $60,000 in match time and volunteers. We have over 30 senior citizens that are over 65 years old, and they're doing all the planting for this. They've been excited about it and working on it. We work directly with our soil water districts. They provide us the technical assistance. We go out, we do the outreach, and they come in when we need help on the projects and do that. In the past, they've been pretty focused on landowners. They're expanding their stuff as well, and working directly with the Watershed Council has been a big benefit. I asked one of my directors from the soil water district, I said, what do you see as the big difference? I'm going tomorrow, and I want to see what your opinion is. And that was what he said was, where the difference is. And I said, well, could you do away with watershed councils and could soil water districts do it on their own? He said, no way. Their focus is a different thing, but yet we should be working together to proceed ahead with it. And it's been kind of nice. The Oregon Watershed and Board has encouraged us to do that and work directly with them. The Oregon Watershed Board has provided assistance to us. Vivian Torgerson is the regional Willamette regional representative for us, and she's helped us with everything from, how do we do this document? What's our legal responsibility? Where do we find some assistance? That's one of the big things that they've been doing for us is, okay, you might go for funding here, or this is some place that you might be able to provide assistance. Last thing, and then I'll stop talking, because I tend to go on. Also there, you'll see as an assessment, that's one of the things that we did was we got together with forestry and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and DEQ and all the entities that are out there, and our assessment gathered together all the known data for the Rickrail Watershed. It was completed in February of 2000, and it's a living document, so we just finished the work with the OSU students, and so this is the new copy of it that's out, and it has their data and their studies in there.
Thank you. You bring a lot of energy. It sounds like you have a really diverse group.
We do. Which is interesting sometimes.
Yeah. Are there any questions? If not, thank you for coming this morning. We've got John McDonald from the Association of Conservation Districts to come and make some comments. Thank you for coming today, John. Appreciate your time. Did you a favor, huh?
Yeah.
tell us a little bit about conservation districts.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is John McDonald. I am the executive director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I also wear three other hats, I think, when I like to talk about this particular situation, and that is I am a director of a local conservation district in Washington County. So I'm not only a paid staff person at the state level, I'm also a volunteer, unpaid director at the local level. And I also have had the privilege of being on the Tualatin River Watershed Council for the last 6 years. Well, actually 8 years now, since 1996. I guess I did 6 years. In 2 years of that, I was the chairman. I can give an unequivocal statement about the relationship of districts and councils. It goes right along with what Jackie Hastings just said. You know, they can be an enormous asset to each other. The question is whether or not they have worked out the situation locally, have arrived at the kinds of working relationships that are suitable, and haven't fallen into some of the traps that that we're occasionally running around the state trying to undo and redo. Let me just give you a little bit of stuff about what this conservation district is all about, and I prepared a few just sort of note sheets. These aren't intended to be, you know, any kind of published documents and so forth. I jotted down things here that I thought might be of interest and tried to do so in a very quick and summary way so that you wouldn't have to spend a lot of time reading. But I'd like to say that conservation districts came about, and I think it's important to know why they came about, what gave rise to their inception in the first place, and therefore by what model do we tend to work. As all of you know, they rose here in the state of Oregon in 1939. And the reason that happened at that year is it was a result of the Dust Bowl. The experience and training of the Dust Bowl throughout the country was that the federal and state resources that were compiled through the federal agencies and some of the state governments in various states to address the issues of erosion and wind, and then they started saying, well, hey, there's other things out there. There's water problems, and there's you know, irrigation problems or no irrigation, and there's, you know, whatever it may be in the locale. And they found out that after a few years' experience of trying to apply those programs, something was missing. And what was missing was the local people who knew the land. The local people who knew the land, who knew the landowners, who knew where the problems were, had a better feel for probably what needs to be done to fix the problems, were going to be there after the, you know, federal technician went back to Washington or the state technician went back to the state capitol, was going to be working with the landowners, was going to be monitoring it through, was going to be advocating for the landowner and so forth. So we found out very quickly that both what Jeff Huntington has said as well others, that you know, you can't do it from Salem, you can't do it from Washington, D.C. You do it locally. You do it where the problem exists with the landowner you're trying to affect. And so that's why conservation districts came into being. We are a result, as you can see. We have a bunch of enabling legislation that says on that first page of governance and structure. We have a set of policies that deal with, you know, who we are and what we can do and what our authorities are. We have special provisions to handle wind erosion in the state, and of course we have been designated as the major planner and implementer of the SB 1010 program, the Agriculture Water Quality Management Plan. We're pleased as all get out to have had the money to do the planning, and now that we're right at the point of we're almost through with the planning, we've arrived at the deadline, and the deadline says the door has been closed because there's not going to be any money for implementation, so now we're going to have to be creative about how we take these plans and put them into effect. You'll notice that this says under directors, there are 291 of us. We are elected in the general elections in November for 4-year terms. The difference between that and some other elected officials is we are not paid. However, I do not like the idea that some people say that we are volunteers, because we're not volunteers. We're elected officials, and therefore with that comes a whole lot of responsibilities that can't be, shall we say, rationalized by saying, oh, I'm just a volunteer. It's not the same, even though we're unpaid. We have 45 districts. We've been here since 1940. The last one was created in 1970-some. We originally, believe it or not, had 65 of them. And then they consolidated down to 45, and some of us in our private world would wish they would consolidate down to about 38. There are a couple places that consolidation would not be a bad thing. There are two directors in each zone that are elected at large, so they represent all the citizens, and the others have the requirement to own a or manage at least 10 acres of property. That doesn't mean own, they just have to manage. So we have directors, for example, who run a city park department. We have managers and so forth, particularly at the at-large thing, that that have no land at all, but they're just interested in conservation. In fact, what we're finding now over the last 4 or 5 years is something I find very exciting, and that is the directorship for districts is changing. You know, back in the 40s, it was basically farm USDA resources being sent from Washington that funded it, and therefore it tended to be farmers who were on the boards. That's changing. We're now getting people who are, admittedly, they walk in and say, I'm an environmentalist, and I want to be on your board. We say, here's a ballot, run. We have some that are appointed. We're getting into other things and just streamlined farming. One of our latest ones in Washington County is a small wetlands owner, woodlands owner. Has a very different orientation than the person across the table who's a dairyman or maybe a wheat rancher or a seed grower, something like that. We have 29 districts that cover an entire county. We have 6 counties that are split into 2 districts, and we have 1 county, Baker County, that has 4. And I won't go into the history of how that happened. It's a long thing that happened a long time ago. You can also see on the other side of this thing that we have a staffing pattern. We have 155 employees. 14 of those happen to be Watershed Council coordinators that are on the payroll of the districts. Of the 141 left or so forth, that it turns out to be about 114 FTEs, so not all people are full-time, but that's how many employees we currently have, as they're scattered over the 45 districts. We feel that we have a lot of potential, and I hate to use the word potential because it's always like, yeah, but you never really got where you're supposed to go, you're still sitting in the land of potential. But over the years, we have used a lot of the things that we have, and so I've included in the stack of materials a list of powers and authorities of conservation districts. As you can see, we can do a lot of things. I think the people in 1939 were pretty wise about what was going on. They may not have said Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act, but they put in words there that allow us to just seamlessly move right into those areas of concern. You'll notice the first one is kind of interesting. Secure surveys and investigations and do research relating to the character of soil erosion, the character of flood water and sediment damage, all phases of the conservation, development, utilization, disposal of water. And we can do a whole lot of stuff. You know, it's all the way down to owning buildings, operating companies to raise money, to run the districts, to contract with people, to provide all kinds of services, including funds and equipment and so forth, to landowners who are trying to do projects. We even have one unusual ability that's only been used a few times, and that is the ability to take over the management of a federal program or even a state program. It's right down there in number 10 and 11. It's happened a couple times, and it's been kind of interesting where the federal program said, well, okay, we've developed it up so far, but we've got other things we want to do, but we want somebody to manage this program. And so they turned it over to a soil conservation district to do that. We can own buildings and stuff like that. We are also, as you may know, a special district, so we have to follow all the special district rules as well. And I don't even have to explain any of what being a public agent or public body means about following contracting rules and public notice and personnel issues and those types of things. But we do have an enormous amount of authority and a very wide thing, and of course our favorite one is to sue or be sued. That's in there too, and we've had the occasion where we've had to do so when somebody reneged on a contract, but obviously we try to stay away from that. So we're very, very proud of the kinds of things that we were given to do and also the suggestions of things we need to do. So let me ask you to turn to the next page and say, okay, how do we translate that into action by this customary functions list? One of our jobs, most importantly, and it's in all the directives that we have when we talk about what I refer to as the long-range business plan, which is the five-year scope of where we're headed. It's a part of the annual work plan, which is required to be sent to the Department of Agriculture annually and must be approved, or we don't get our money from the Department of Agriculture. And it is also that body of data that goes into what we call the local working group. The local working group is the group that gets together and tries to figure out how to target all of the farm bill resources that are coming into that area. And so that's a very, very important function. And we start off by saying, we've got to know what the resource concerns are. Now, there's a lot of ways to say that. I mean, what are the problems? What are the conservation issues, et cetera? We've just chosen to lump them all into one term, and so everybody knows what we mean. What are the resource concerns? What are the things that we don't like it the way it is, and this is the way we want it to be, and then the issue is how to get there? So the first thing to do is bring in stakeholders together for assessment, surveys, local groups, and long-range planning. And I can tell you right now, that is an area where we rely heavily on watershed councils. Now, please note that the watershed councils are a very different model. So, you know, it's not one thing in every single place. The watershed council in my county of Washington County is very, very different from the watershed councils in Wasco, for example, where they're primarily focus groups dealing with their own particular area, their canyon maybe even, of 50 people get together and what are we going to do about our canyon? What do we want it to look like? But they are an invaluable source of data, priorities, values, concerns, impressions, and so forth. And we use conservation needs assessments. We determine resource concerns. We set priorities, and then we recommend what needs to be done. Obviously, we do not have the resources, nor have we ever had the resources to do everything that needs to be done. So we look to other stakeholders, just like watershed councils do. We look to NRCS of what can get through the Farm Bill. We look through Fish and Wildlife. We look through BPA. We look through, you know, federal, state, local fundraisings. We've run auctions to get money to try to put things into projects and so forth to come up with it. The second thing we do is we develop long-range plans, which we call business plans, that have a specific guide to them. It's like 8 pages of please cover the following things. But it centers around a very, very detailed description of what is the problem and what do you want it to be and what is it going to take to get from the way it is to the way it should be. That's the whole focus. And then what are you going to do about it? If you don't have the resources to address those concerns, what are your strategies? Where are you going to go? Is it going to be a grant? Is it going to be maybe a change of regulation? Who knows? What do you advocate to make the problem better? We develop annual plans, and then our key thing that we think we do as well or better than anybody is provide technical assistance. And that's, I even listed 7 different ways to do that. Believe it or not, some of that technical assistance is research. Because I'm sorry, I'm kind of like Jay Nicholas. Science has not given us all the answers yet. We still have to go out and try some things, and sometimes we have to fail because, well, that didn't work until we do, you know, the typical trial and error like every other experimentation, until we find something that works. So we do lots of demonstrations of what may or may not go to produce the desired effect. Marketing, consultation, project planning, conservation, implementing, and monitoring practices. Obviously, we monitor practices. We don't monitor water quality overall and stuff like that. We leave that to, you know, the OWEB staff and their strategies of how they work with other agencies to do that. We approve individual landowner conservation plans. I'm sure some people here do not realize that when a plan comes under the Farm Bill, for example, even if the NRCS technician writes the plan, it can't be funded until it comes to a conservation district. We review it and approve it. Or we disapprove it. Or we send it back to go over that again. Or, you know, there's not enough of whatever we feel needs to be done. So we do an awful lot of reviewing, targeting, and we have an awful lot of sway over where that money ought to go. As opposed to just anybody who comes to the door, because we want the priority issues dealt with first. We are now actually negotiating that we would be the sign-off for the WRP programs, the watershed restoration projects.
What happens under E in your outline if you get to a point where you can't approve an individual landowner conservation plan?
We have a standing policy that says we never say no. We say not yet. We say, okay, here is the concern with the application that has been brought to us. That concern is communicated to the planner. It is communicated to the landowner. And sometimes we send out an additional specialist with, and usually one of our directors goes along and we say, you know, there wasn't enough of this, or it didn't quite do this, or it didn't take into account this and stuff like that. Can we go back? So what we're saying is let's redo the thing. Let's rethink it. Maybe from a different approach, maybe by doing multiple approaches, maybe by collaborating with a landowner nearby. We turned down one because we realized that that landowner couldn't do what they were going to do because part of the problem was created by the landowner upstream or up the hill. It was an erosion situation. So we had to get both landowners to build the system. So, you know, all the money down at the bottom would have been wasted. It was a good idea. It was the right thing to do. But it would have been wasted because the person up the hill wasn't taking care of the water that was coming over their land. Got them both to cooperate, went back, and things were fine.
Okay.
You know, so something like that can happen easily. We act as a local management agency for agriculture water quality management plans. We conduct public information education outreach. Review and evaluate progress, accomplishments, and failures, obviously like that, and then chair this local work group, which is has an awful lot of authority in deciding what practices, what costs, how much cash, you know, cost share and so forth will be allowed to do certain things. So that's kind of the things that conservation districts do on as a regular basis. We obviously work with an awful lot of different agencies. And there's even a sheet right behind that. Well, excuse me, let me talk about the funding part first. Our funding is amazing. We're just filthy rich. We get approximately $8,000 a year from the Department of Agriculture as administrative funds. And those administrative funds go for the money to develop the business plan, prepare the annual work plan, to do the audit, sometimes of which are up to, you know, $2,000 up to $4,000 a piece. That's done by a CPA firm. Fiscal reporting, office space, and so forth. And then we've got some local management agency money that's come through EPA 319 monies, and we've just been told that that's going to be cut by 60%. So we're not going to be doing so much LMA work of actually preparing and implementing the SB 1010 plans. It's important, I think, to understand that nowhere in the tradition or in the statutes of ODA does it say they're responsible to fund districts. That has been an understanding or an assumption, I guess, because they have administrative oversight on us, that therefore they ought to be the funder of districts, and that's not the case. We have had during this last year about $34,000 we could give out annually to each county through the 66 money that came into OWEB's budget through a legislative note to be passed over to ODA to be passed out to the districts. And then we put a bunch of clamps on how that money could go out there and made it, they had to really be accountable for it. They got it quarterly. If they missed certain things, they didn't get their next quarterly. You know, we actually had one district that went the entire year because it was not in our estimation. They weren't doing what was necessary to do it. So there's a lot of accountability to that. We've also gone into the ideas of districts finding other ways. They're competitive grant applicants, like everybody else, with OWEB and other sources, BPA, you name it. We do a lot of tree sales and auctions and so forth to try to get as much local contact. At the same time, we're doing some good, getting things planted out there. And we now have at least three districts who have permanent tax rates. It is our opinion, frankly, that is the future of conservation districts. That's where it ought to be. We shouldn't be going to the legislature. We shouldn't be going to OWEB. We shouldn't be going to other sources. We ought to be, since we are local governments handling a particular area. It would be best if we were paid by local taxes, as is now in Yamhill and has been for 20-some years. Marion, the last session, and then Polk, this last go-around, was approved. We wish we could get it statewide. That, frankly, is the dream. And how we get there, who knows? Now, the second part of this whole thing is that I'd like to address is how do we get this information about what's going on in the county, what are the needs and so forth of which we work. Districts have been instrumental in helping develop watershed councils. We are all in favor of watershed councils. We like the idea that they are good forums for discussion and planning and coming up with some things that can be done, and even stakeholders, you know, who have the ability to step up and say, well, I can address that problem, I'll take it on. Something that's been identified. We do, however, have some concerns about some of the things that have been happening. I'll use my own watershed council and district as an example. The Watershed Council Steering Committee came to the district and said, we want to separate. We want to be on our own. We want to have our own employee, and we want to have our own supervision. We said, do you have the authority to be an employer of record? No. Well, then they wanted us to be the employer of record, but have absolutely no supervisory authority whatsoever. And, of course, we said, we can't do that. We can't do that legally. We can't do that. We can't divorce our liability. We can't give up all the what about overtime, what about an accident, what about, you know, these other things that, put, you know, the employer at risk. So a whole lot of risk management things. And I can understand why districts, why councils want to do that. It's natural evolutionary growth. You know, I've been hanging around you guys for a while, and now I think I'm ready to go out on my own. Organizations do that all the time. Businesses do that all the time. But it's created some problems when you only want to go halfway. The other problem that I find difficult is everybody says there's enough work to go around for everybody. And boy, is that true. But there isn't enough money to go around for everybody to be doing everything they want to do. And sometimes that means that some of these things where we started out being very collaborative, we're now actually almost competitive. I happen to have loved the first 2 years I was chairman of the Watershed Council because I had a watershed coordinator that I got to train. You may not like it because it's now Representative Jackie Dingfelder. But she worked for me for 2 years, and we had a fabulous relationship. Over the course of the years, with change of leaderships and a very different personality in the watershed coordinator position, it's become strained. I think we need some way to help districts and councils fashion definitions of roles and working relationships that would make it more productive. And some of that's how the funding is done. Maybe some of that's how we put on incentives for people who do choose to work together and are doing it the way it ought to be done by theory. I would also like to say in closing, and I'm sure you're looking at the clock, OACD and the Department of Agriculture are working very, very hard to say, we recognize the challenge. We recognize that we districts need to gear up our capacities. So we're engaging on a full-blown funding system that's going into training actually this next week. We have developed an entire guidebook with all the stuff about open meetings laws and planning and stuff like that. And Larry Ouyou and I took it literally district by district and spent a day training the directors about what it means to be a district, what it means to be an elected official, and those types of things. We're working with guidebooks. We're working with models about business planning. Probably the thing that I will confess to you is something we haven't had the time or money to develop is a good reporting system. I sat down and read all of the annual work plans and all 45 of the annual reports. I wish I had the skill to bring to you and in 5 minutes tell you what it took me 2 days to read, because it is absolutely outstanding. I was overwhelmed, and I've been in the business a long time as a director and so forth. I was overwhelmed about the amount of work that these people were doing, and it made me extremely proud of them. I wish I had a picture and a graph to show you in a fancy, you know, annual report. I don't. We don't have the money or maybe the skill to do it, but we're going to find it. Because I think it's needed. You need to know better what's going on out there than I'm able to tell you. That's about it, sir.
I think we've had several comprehensive reports this morning. And I appreciate it, because if we're trying to be a natural resource committee and an ag committee that understands, excuse the pun, the lay of the land, we should be hearing from you and know what you're doing.
One thing you do not have to work,
go ahead,
Chair Shields, is to find people who want to work.
I agree with you. I really do. One of the things I heard your reference to training your own watershed staff person when you were on the Watershed Council.
Mm-hmm.
Do all the Watershed Councils start out with soil and water conservation districts? Did they all start out that way?
I don't believe all started out that way, no. But I think, I'll bet there were more than half started that way.
Okay.
If not directly as the SWCD, child, but maybe we were involved in the process.
Okay.
I mean, we didn't create it ourselves, but we were involved with the county and RCND and Clean Water Services and all the other agencies, mm-hmm. Saying we need a forum for discussion. And that's what we created it to be. It's morphed into something else, but that's what we started out with.
I appreciate the chance to meet you today and to learn.
It's been my pleasure being here. Thank you for your attention.
I wanted to make a quick announcement again. Anybody that wants to have a chance to react to this or any other information, we have that opportunity on Friday. Please get, why don't you tell them your phone number again, Judith?
Yes, and for those of you listening, I'll give the complete phone number, 503-986-1688. My name is Judith. Please do call me and we'll get you on the list.
And if we have a fuller schedule, we'll move from 8:30 to 8, but if we can fit it in, we're going to leave our time at 8:30. So we'll see you on Friday, and with that, we're adjourned.